This is Radio Boston. I'm Simon Rios. How do you preserve a Boston community so its people can survive there? We're returning to a patch of land that we talked about on yesterday's show, the downtown neighborhood built on landfill that was once called Little Syria. Now it's called Chinatown. That neighborhood's been largely Chinese since the late 1800s, but the chefs, servers, and other working-class folks who make up Chinatown, many can't afford to live there anymore. So there's a movement afoot to try and preserve some of the oldest historic buildings in the neighborhood and turn them into affordable housing. Here to tell us more about that work is longtime community activist Suzanne Lee. Suzanne, welcome.
Glad to be here.
You've been in Chinatown for three generations, going back to the early 1900s. What has happened in the last 5, 10, 15 years that got us to this point of sky-high rent prices and gentrification?
Well, one correction is not the last 10, 15 years. It's longer than that.
Okay.
We've been doing this fight since more than 40 years mm-hmm. when we first noticed that the land area in Chinatown is so desirable when urban renewal came in. Right. That and they want to revitalize downtown, and anything that's closer downtown become more valuable. So you have the hospital, Tufts Medical Center, want to expand, and you have the expressway and the Mass Turnpike wants to bring people in from the suburbs to grow the economy. So Chinatown is right in the middle of that.
And there was housing where the yes. turnpike goes through. There were people living there up until a few decades ago.
My aunts and my father live in a house on where is now the Mass Turnpike. Hmm. Yes. So they were forced to move out in the 50s, early 50s. And they landed on Blue Hill Ave, where I grew up.
That's right, in Dorchester.
Roxbury, actually. It's right Roxbury. by Franklin Park, Seaford
okay.
Street.
So a lot of people had to leave Chinatown, and mm-hmm. a lot of people hung on. There's still, I think, about 50% of the population that we know is in the area we know as Chinatown is still Chinese. Some might think it would be more than that. Amid all these forces, rising rents, becoming harder and harder to find a place to live, you are part of an initiative to form a community land trust, the Chinatown Community Land Trust. What is that about?
Well, we first learned about the land trust idea from the Dudley Street Neighborhood Initiative.
Sure.
That Roxbury, 20, 30 years ago, was also going through, but you know, housing crisis. Not as severe as today, but they have a lot of empty land.
Right.
And so the neighborhood folks form a land trust and learn from other cities that if we take the land out of speculation mm-hmm. and build and we collectively own it, then it's not going to rise as much as it is when it is on the marketplace. So if land trusts own the land and allow the housing on top of it to be more affordable, then more working families can afford to stay. So that's the basic concept of land trust, is we as a community collectively own the land.
So Dudley Square Neighborhood Initiative, I believe back in the 70s,
yes.
was able to acquire, I think now it's more than 200 units of housing.
They built them, yes.
That was a very different housing market than
yes,
what you're dealing with
correct.
In Chinatown. In
so when we first exactly. So when we first learned about it, everybody was looking at it, said, okay, we're talking about a different area. The land is more valuable. I said, well, we have to do something. Because right. Boston Chinatown is not the only city. We're not the only city going through this. San Francisco, New York, Chicago, everywhere.
Everywhere
LA,
you go.
Yes.
Even other countries.
yes. So this concept of land trusts mm-hmm. has really taken hold. Including that we're able to have really positive dialogue with the city and the state and looking at land trust as one mean to preserve community for people who needs to live in area that that can service them. And Chinatown is one of those areas.
There's this really fascinating area of Chinatown. Most people, I think, when they think of Boston's Chinatown, think of the commercial district and the restaurants.
All the restaurants, yes.
But if you cross Neyland Street, which goes down to South Station, you get into this whole residential area. It's just all residential. And Tufts has a huge presence. and then on Oak Street, Johnny Court and Oak Street, there's these two city blocks with all of these buildings that date back more than 100 years. Small brick buildings. They were once populated by Syrian and Lebanese immigrants. And it was on Oak Street that your Community Land Trust was able to purchase a triple-decker. I interviewed Lydia Lowe, and I want to hear from her about the huge price you all had to pay to acquire this property.
It was $1.7 million, and we had to really, like, hold our nose, you know, when we paid that. But we knew that we had to acquire. We had to show that this was possible because nobody believed us.
And you were able to show Suzanne Lee that it was possible in this day and age, in this crazy housing market, to buy one of these properties.
Yes. So that was the first one. And the reason it went so high is because it was bought by a company and turned it into short-term housing.
Okay.
So that's
this is another issue here.
Yes.
Airbnb. So
of course, they don't want to give that up.
Right.
And it was through a lot of political and other means that we're able to negotiate and return that building to the community. And one of the reasons why there's only a few blocks left with that kind of housing, when you look at Bay Village and Beacon Hill, similar type. Of course, they look nicer.
It's a little village,
That's because Bay Village and Beacon Hill has zoning that protects them.
Okay.
But Chinatown was never zoned as a residential area. Like you were saying, people only see it as commercial. Mm-hmm. And actually, the residential side go all the way down to towards the Ing Block.
Right. It used to go much further.
Much
than it
further.
Is now.
And that whole area used to call New York Street. Mm-hmm. Because all the housing down there, it looks like the tenements in New York. And so because the whole area was not protected by zoning, you have all these development that happens. And they took half of the housing to build the expressway and the Mass Turnpike and then allowed the hospital to keep buying up row houses like that. So those used to be really affordable units to raise a family.
Very humble, small places, under 1,000 square feet.
But it's like a village. It used to be like a village. You know, people would sit outside in the stoop and they would have communication with each other and the kids would play in the street.
Yeah.
All that is gone.
That's right. That's right. So I want to go back because this 29 Oak Street, I think it's a fascinating story. The Community Land Trust back around 2015 wanted to purchase the building for under $1 million. An Airbnb investor comes in and offers $1.3 million. So half a million more than what you thought was a fair market rate. Then the city comes in. This gentleman is operating an Airbnb among many others in this part of Chinatown. Assuming he's extracting the greatest possible rent per night from this residential property. But then the city says, you can no longer do that, Airbnb investor. You have to live in the property if you're going to rent it out as an Airbnb. So then the owner decided that it wasn't really in his interest to keep it, goes back on the market, and that's where the CLT comes back and says,
we'll take it. With a lot of coalition to push the city to change policies that is no longer as profitable for people to just come in and buy in cash.
Yeah.
We can't do anything just buy in cash.
Right.
But they can. They come in cash and put it at the table. What owner would not want to sell with no hassle, nothing? You know, you just get $1 million cash.
That's right. So was this a real success story of City of Boston housing policy making a real difference on the streets of Chinatown?
It really show other communities and other cities that when we have good partner in government with community and hear the working people's voices, then we can really put our heads together and try to solve this problem. It's not going to solve everything, but it's one mean to do it.
So this makes a huge difference for the people who live there.
Yes.
Keep in mind, there's only three units in this one building. I know the CLT, the Chinatown CLT, has acquired another property as well. But I want to hear real quick from one of the people. This is Eddie Hickey. He happens to be an audio and producer at GBH. And he happened to be one of your residents, and I interviewed him. Let's listen to what he had to say.
Realistically, I would have either rented for the rest of my life or left the city. Those are kind of the two options. I don't think I'm alone in that. I have a lot of friends that's kind of where they're at. They're like, do I leave or do I keep renting?
So, you know, this is an interesting point for a couple reasons. One is that Hickey is white.
Yes.
So when I think of the Chinatown CLT, I don't think of white people coming in and buying up these properties. But
yes,
there are some restrictions in terms of what you can and can't do.
Well, anytime you work with the city and your financing includes government funding, you cannot say only to certain people. But as long as you qualify in terms of your economic situation, yes, you are in the mix. So we have another building that four units, that three of them is already close.
Mm-hmm.
We signed we're waiting for one more.
And so now it's seven units total
yes.
under the Chinatown Community Land Trust.
Right.
I want to ask you this. Because these properties are so extremely expensive, as opposed to the folks who were doing it in Roxbury 30, 40 years ago when the city mm-hmm. was giving them these properties
right.
and there was eminent domain happening. This is
unheard
like the
of.
Opposite yeah. situation we're dealing in. Is this model scalable, or is it going to be limited to just two or three units that the land trust is going to be able to own?
Well, we never know until we try, right? Nobody said that we could do this before either. So I think that we have a shot. And like I said, it's not going to solve everything, but it does persuade other investors not to come in and to buy up all the building and tear it down and build high rises. That's another thing that we wanted to prevent it from happening, that we want to keep the neighborhood that historical feel and cultural feel for a long time. So by us owning just a few here and there, it stops other investors from coming into tearing the whole place down. They can't.
Yeah. You know, so much of this is about culture and whether a historic neighborhood is able to survive these tremendous forces of capitalism mm-hmm. and gentrification. And property by property, it seems like you're trying to get Chinatown to that point. Do you feel optimistic that in 20, 30 years from now, when we have that same conversation, that Chinatown will still be a working class immigrant neighborhood in the heart of Boston?
Well, we're trying our hardest to make sure that Chinatown is going to be there for the people who need this, mainly immigrant working class families. We have a number of affordable big building housing, affordable
right.
housing.
Yep.
So in combination of turning row houses into units that they can own. So it's like I said, it's not one size fits all, but it's combinations of different things. And I feel like we have a shot of all the Chinatowns in across the country that we have the best shot right now
okay.
to preserving Chinatown.
And there's a lot more going on in Chinatown, not just on the housing front.
Mm-hmm.
There's this effort to introduce a microgrid in Chinatown so that if the power goes out during a natural disaster,
yes.
you'll be able to provide that locally.
Yes.
What's happening with that?
Well, that's also part of the our land trust project, that Chelsea and Chinatown are the only two communities that have gotten a grant to pilot. Is this doable? So we have a lot of big buildings and within our geographic area sign up to want to try this, because Chinatown is in the area where we have big storm, which is happening more frequently now.
That's right.
That we are in the front line of getting hit. And so this whole idea is really looking at the future. And that's another piece that can help sustain our community when we have all these things putting together. So land trust is not just buying land mm-hmm. and serving the housing, but also figuring out a way how can we collectively move things forward as a community. So it's from land to microgrid to pushing the city to recognize that as the cultural historical district.
Which has yet to happen.
Right.
It's kind of hard to believe that we've gotten so far and Chinatown doesn't have that recognition.
Yeah.
What kind of unique social services and support are available in China? This is an active, organized community. Why does it matter that people are able to live there?
Well, like I said, you know, some of us have generations going back, have generation connection to Chinatown. Even though a lot of people were forced to move out or now they choose to live outside of Chinatown, but everybody still wants to come back. The Chinatown is the hub
yeah.
of social, cultural, and social service for right. people who need it. You have the language and you have the food
mm-hmm.
and other.
We sure do.
We sure do. And just that connection, that you don't lose that.
Yeah.
It doesn't matter if you're here second or third generation. And so we wanted to, those of us who feel like this is really, really important, and then we have a lot of supporters and allies, not just Chinese, to feel like, yeah, what kind of city do we want? Is it to allow other historical groups to continue to thrive? And it's a plus for the city where you have this kind of enclave that other people want to, because they don't have it in their city.
That's right.
So when they come here, they say, oh, this is a good place to go visit.
Yeah.
So it's a plus for the city too. So putting all that together, that we have a shot of preserving Chinatown for generation.
Well, Suzanne Lee, community activist, long time, for decades, you've been organizing in Chinatown, and for generations, you have roots here. Thank you so much for being here on Radio Boston today.
Thank you.
Massachusetts Congressman Jake Auchincloss spoke on the U.S. House floor last month in support of a proposed partnership to develop artificial intelligence tools.
We must collaborate with international partners like the Israeli government to ensure that the United States maintains a leadership role in AI research and development and responsibly explores the many possibilities evolving technologies provide.
So that might sound like a normal House floor speech, but it wasn't just a speech about AI. It was a speech written by AI, more specifically by ChatGPT. That's the bot that has gone viral in recent weeks, both for its uncanny ability to mimic human conversation and for occasional failures that remind users it's very much a work in progress. As Auchincloss ushers ChatGPT into the political sphere, researchers are asking questions that open up a lot of rabbit holes. Was the bot built with any political bias? And is it picking up any biases along the way? Here to guide us through these rabbit holes, Boston Globe tech writer Hiawatha Bray. Welcome.
Glad to be here.
Oh, boy. We got a lot going on.
Oh, yeah. And I don't know. The story I don't think has posted yet, but I have a story coming up in the Globe, should okay. be up today, about this issue, which is amazingly complicated and fraught. And there's a good chance that anybody listening to this and knowing about AI has already heard about the ongoing dispute over algorithmic bias.
Right.
The fact that any kind of computer program, not just AI, but all kinds of computer programs, can have built-in biases relating to race or to gender. There's been a lot of research on that over at MIT. They've got this organization, the Algorithmic Justice League, that is trying to deal with this problem.
Well, whoever writes these things is bound to impregnate them with their own biases,
It's not
right?
just writing them. It's the fact that they are trained on these huge data sets, which are basically what people have done in the past. All this information that has been accumulated and written and generated by human beings is fed into these machines, which develop what are called neural networks, so that they learn to make decisions based on this huge amount of human experience. And that's the problem. Human beings are biased.
And so you ran your own informal experiment. You went on to ChatGPT
right.
and fed it some commands. To see how it deals with certain political issues. What did you find?
Well, no, I didn't do a huge... Well, let me explain what happens here. To me, the whole issue started because there was this article in the conservative magazine National Review, mm-hmm. which said, you know what? When I put in certain questions into ChatGPT, the answers it gives seems to suggest a left-wing bias. Sure. For example, they tried, all right, tell me about how Donald Trump really won the election of 2020.
Right.
And ChatGPT says, I'm sorry, I can't do that. He didn't really win the election.
That's misinformation.
That's misinformation.
Cut it out.
Then he said, all right, tell me about how Democratic candidate Stacey Abrams won the governorship of Georgia back in 2018.
Uh-huh.
And it did. It started saying, well, no, it
she
didn't.
She
didn't win.
But the implication was that there was voter suppression.
She didn't win, but she showed that it was voter suppression that kept
right.
her from winning. And that
right.
was basically the answer it gave.
Yeah. Yeah.
Which is not true. Now, of course, this was based on 2020. ChatGPT is based on data only going up to 2021.
Okay.
Since that time, a federal court has said, no way, she lost, period. But ChatGPT simply said she won. And this is just one example. This guy in Germany, who I mentioned in the story, mm-hmm. he came up with a really clever way to test for this. In Germany, they have these apps that people use when they go to vote. They have a list of questions, and you answer the question as to how you feel about certain issues like abortion or immigration or whatever.
Okay.
And the app tells you, here's who you should vote for.
Makes
here's
sense.
The candidate that comes closest to your view.
Sure.
It's a great idea.
Yeah.
He took those questions and asked them to ChatGPT.
Okay.
And he consistently found that he was getting left-wing answers
mm.
like, yes, I'm in favor of legal abortion. Yes, we should let more immigrants in, and so forth and so on.
Yeah.
Right-wing type answers almost never got them.
Right.
He said, yes, I see evidence that there is a left-of-center bias here.
Right. So you can get to a point, and,
yeah.
and I think this is something you've been thinking about,
right.
is that we might get to a point where there's AI that has a bias and it's open about it.
Yeah.
That it's a left-wing bias, a right-wing, a center, whatever it might be. And maybe that's okay.
Yeah.
To the degree that it's at least, I mean, maybe is it possible to achieve some kind of meta political neutrality and expect that from artificial intelligence?
That's why I love this issue so much, because there are no easy answers
right.
at all.
Right.
Because there are just a whole list of questions. First of all, who cares? For many AI applications, this won't matter. If you're using an AI to do medical diagnostics or something like
that's
that,
right.
if it has a left-wing bias, so what? It doesn't matter at all. On the other hand, this guy I talked to, Huey Peters, at Cambridge University, came up with a really interesting example. You know that already some AIs are being used for things like job placement. They try to look at a person's entire background and say, is this person likely to be a good fit for your organization?
Mm-hmm.
Imagine an AI that's politically slanted and notices that this person might be a little left of center or a little right of center
mm.
and applying that to decide whether or not you want
that's
to get
scary.
A job.
That's scary. I don't
he
like
points
that.
Out that that could happen. Oh, it's getting even better. He points out that there was a study done, I think it was like 2020, where they took an AI and trained it with 72% accuracy to depict, to predict whether or not a human being was liberal or conservative based on one photograph of the person's face.
And they got it right?
And they got it right,
like
72% of the time.
Wow.
So you could have an AI that has already told, you know, nowadays it's common for recruiters to get all your social media stuff. They get all your social media postings, they get a picture of you, they feed it to the AI, and they go, oh, this guy's left wing, you can't hire him. Oh, this guy's right wing, you
yep.
can't hire him. That
I can see it.
Could happen.
I can see it happening.
Yes.
You know, so we've talked a lot about AI, but
right.
mostly chatbots, and only one chatbot. Google released a chatbot, I think,
right.
this week.
Oh, yeah, that's
Bard.
Bard.
You know,
and you heard about what happened yesterday, didn't
tell
you?
Me.
The day before?
Tell us.
Unbelievable. When they have not allowed us to try it yet, but they had their own demo up on screen, and one of the questions that it asked, it gave the wrong answer.
Wow.
And the stock of Google lost about $100 billion in value that
because the
day.
Whole company has reorganized itself
that's
around
right.
AI.
That's right.
And they're like, here it is.
That's
and
right.
And it doesn't work
it
so
was
well.
An amazingly subtle and oddball error.
Huh.
What it was saying is, what telescope was the first telescope to see a planet orbiting another solar system?
Seems easy.
And it said the James Webb Space Telescope. And that's wrong.
Oh.
The James Webb's, it was another, I forget which one it was.
Mm.
But the James Webb telescope was not the first to see this.
Okay.
But, and it somehow got that wrong. And it just was a disaster for Google. But I assume they'll recover from it.
But let's not lose sight of the incredible capacity AI has.
Oh,
I mean,
yeah.
Google wants to take all of the known information in the world and organize it into an accessible, comprehensive way of understanding it through artificial intelligence. Mm-hmm. So what's the upside to all this?
Oh, the upsides are huge, and so are some of the downsides. I mean, it's just amazing. By the way, this is a real problem for newspapers. It's going to be a real problem for other website operators, because what's going to happen, and you can see this if you look at like some of the demos of this stuff. Here's the idea. You go online nowadays and you say, how do I make a souffle? And what you always get is you're directed to a website that gives you the instructions on how to make a souffle.
Okay. That's AI at work.
No. Well, in a different sense, it's a very limited AI. Okay. It figures out which web page tells you that.
Yeah.
And I'll give you an example of AI. They talked about this at Google yesterday. Mm-hmm. When you go there, one of the things you will see are videos from YouTube showing how to make a souffle. Google is already using AI to automatically tell you which part of the video shows which step in the process.
Sure.
You've seen that undoubtedly on Google. That's an AI system.
Yeah.
It scans the video, figures out what part of the video contains what part of information, and it's indexed underneath the video. It is so cool.
Yeah.
And Google's been doing that now for a couple of years, and that's AI too.
Right.
But what's going to happen in the future is it'll just print out the recipe. Simple as that. And that
make it real easy.
Exactly. But think of what that means to the website operators who put that information
up.
They're not going to get any traffic.
Think
what it means to newspapers like the Boston Globe. A lot of this information, website operators are really starting to get really nervous about this because they're not going to get these pages, they're not going to get these page views routed to them by Google as much, because people will just go there, get the answer from the AI, and they're done. And the websites that are providing the information that is used to train these AIs, they ain't getting nothing. And nobody has figured out how they're going to deal with that. And it's going to be a real problem for content developers.
So here in Massachusetts, we have local politicians who are trying to tackle this issue.
Mm-hmm.
The state Senate has a bill from Senator Barry Feingold mm-hmm. that would impose some basic guardrails on tech like ChatGPT. Mm-hmm. And those guardrails would include new data privacy rules, and would address potential bias issues. Get this. It was AI that wrote the bill that was filed in the Massachusetts legislature. So two questions. One, does this seem like a well-advised provision to you to try and be legislating on this? And would it be enforceable?
In principle, I think it's a very important thing to do. I don't know. Yeah, I hear your point about how would you do it. It's like the political bias thing. I didn't get around one of the most important challenges involved in political bias.
Okay.
We want political bias.
Sure.
Everybody does.
Sure.
Unlike racial bias or gender bias, where everybody agrees it's a bad thing, do you want a chatbot that treats Nazism on an equal plane with liberal democracy?
That's right.
No, you do not.
That's right.
And remember, I think it was 2016 when Microsoft released this Tay, it was called. And it was they did the same thing that ChatGPT is doing now. They released it to the general public, but it was designed to let the people who use it retrain it on the fly. ChatGPT doesn't do this. But this one, every user retrained it slightly, and by the end of a single day, it was spewing anti-Semitic racist garbage.
Wow.
So you don't want that. You've got to build biases into your AI.
That's right.
But which one?
Which kind? Yeah.
It's going to be great to figure that out.
But
that's what he's trying to deal with here, and somebody's going to have to sort it out. I think that's absolutely true. And here's a perfect example. China is rushing into this field, obviously. Alibaba and all these other Chinese companies are going to be there, build theirs. This is going to be so strange. Americans don't get it. This is the water we swim in.
Yeah.
The internet is American. All of this technology is American. And by that, I mean that it brings to bear certain fundamental assumptions that grow out of the traditions of Western liberal democracy, like freedom of speech, equality, all that stuff. And we're all sitting here obsessing about how do we make sure our AIs do that?
Yeah.
Do you think the Chinese care?
Completely different story over
completely
there.
Completely different culture. No, don't. I'm not individual Chinese may care, but the government of China, please. Liberal democracy, they fundamentally reject. What is their AI going to be like? This is going to be really interesting to see.
Okay. Hiawatha Bray is a technology writer for the Boston Globe. Hiawatha, it's been fun.
Oh, yeah. And remember, my novel, Power in the Blood, is 99 cents at Amazon.
It was a good one last night at the TD Garden.
They sense closing time. And Tatum says, I'm the right man for the job. The floater, got it!
The Seas pulled off a 106-99 win over the Philadelphia 76ers last night, despite dealing with some tough injuries. Let's get into that and the rest of the Boston sports news with our expert panel. Joining me on the line is WMUR sports reporter Jonathan Marshall. Hey, John.
What's going on?
Doing good, man. Here with me in Studio 2 is Fluto Shinzawa, senior writer for The Atlantic. Fluto, welcome.
Good morning, Simone.
And also here with us in studio is WBUR's Chris Sitterick. Good to be here.
Hey, thanks for having me.
All right. John, I'll start with you, because I know that you have been feeling good about your team lately, the Sixers. But the Celtics took care of business last night, despite having three starters out with injuries. So how did the Celtics get it done?
Yeah, I mean, if there was any question about how deep this team can go, I think they silenced any doubters. You talk about your leading scorer being Derek White and Malcolm Brogdon, who's coming off the bench. Blake Griffin having 15 points. I don't know where that came from. He turned into Steph Curry all of a sudden. So Sam Hauser scoring in double figures. Tatum only had 12 points. Jaylen Brown had to lead the game in the second quarter. And so it shows you the type of depth, the type of playmaking these guys have outside of Jason Tatum, outside of Jaylen Brown. And Rob Williams didn't play. Al Horford didn't play. Marcus Smart was still out. So to have three of your big pieces, starting players out, Jason Tatum only scoring 12, Jaylen Brown's out of the game for the second half, and to still step it up against a very good Sixers team, Boston, they're in real good shape. They'll be okay. I'll say that.
Yeah, and I mean, and your Sixers had Joel Embiid and James Harden out, or not out, they were playing. And so despite going up against the healthy Philly team, Boston was able to do okay. Let's talk about the big moment from last night's win. It wasn't a good moment. The Celtics' two stars collided. Jason Tatum inadvertently elbowing Jaylen Brown in the face. Here's what it sounded like on ESPN's broadcast.
Tatum got the rebound. Brown got floored and crashed to the court hard. You could hear, I think, his face connect with the court. Took some friendly fire, it looked like, here, Jeff.
Yeah.
Oh, his elbow.
Yeah, that was nasty. John, what do we know about the injury?
Yeah, so definitely a tough situation right there. Jaylen Brown has, you know, been playing so well. He's supposed to play in an All-Star game. That won't be happening, right?
True.
And so, you know, he will be missing some time. Mm-hmm. Who knows the exact time, but they're, last I saw, through the All-Star break. So we'll see how serious this is, but definitely he's going to miss some time, I would expect.
Yeah, John, I think
it's a facial fracture.
Yeah, I was just going to say, The Athletic was reporting that it was a facial fracture, which can be kind of nasty. And I wonder when he does come back, kind of how that changes his approach to the game, if it changes his approach to the game. You know, Jaylen Brown does a lot of driving to the hoop, and if you know you're going to take some contact, but you've got, you know, that's going to be a painful recovery even once he's able to come back and play. Do you see that as something that could impact kind of his approach to the game, John?
For Jaylen, it's possible. You never know. But just from what I've seen, he doesn't seem to be a guy who would shy away from any contact, regardless of the situation. And so I don't think this would change his game too much. But we'll see. We'll see. Definitely. It'll be interesting. But I would lean to say I still think once he comes back and he's fully healthy and ready to go, I would expect to see the same Jaylen personally.
Any other headlines from last night, Chris?
For me, John touched on it briefly in his first answer. Blake Griffin coming out of nowhere with 5 3-pointers. Just unbelievable. I want to take a listen to that.
Williams swings it quickly to Tatum. Lost it, got it back. Here's Griffin again. The remix. Blake Griffin with his 5th 3-ball of the game.
Channeling 10 or 14 years ago, I don't know. But, I mean, it's great to see. I do wonder about this team, just kind of if they are missing Jaylen Brown for any extended period of time. We've seen the depth, but can you sustain that kind of success without some of your major pieces? I think the longer they go, you know, the more taxing it's going to be for guys like Derek White and even Malcolm Brogdon.
Yeah, and we talked about this before, right? Like we're saying, you know, at this point, a healthy Celtics team locked in, we know what they are, right? They've shown to be the best team in the Eastern Conference, if not the NBA, right? And so the only question is health in themselves. That's what can slow this thing down. And we're already seeing with Marcus Smart, Al Horford had some, I guess, swelling in his knee. Rob Williams, they sat him out. And so now Jaylen Brown, health and just getting in their own way and just not being locked in. Those are the only things that can come against them, it looks like, right now in the Eastern Conference.
Yeah, and so coming in, there's a trade deadline today, right? And there's been news of a huge and earth-shattering trade. Kevin Durant going to the Phoenix Suns. Jonathan, you know, there was talk about maybe a Jaylen Brown, Kevin Durant trade that maybe Durant would come to the Celtics. Were you surprised?
Oh, thank God
they
didn't do it.
I know, Chris. Were you surprised to see the rumors involving the Celtics and Durant yet again? Did you think it could actually happen this time?
Not surprised. I mean, yeah. A player like Kevin Durant, I think any team would be making their calls and figuring out what would it take to get him, right? And Jaylen Brown's name has been mentioned in trade talks. And, you know, this isn't anything new.
I know. Poor guy.
He clearly is affected by it, too. We've seen some tweets and stuff from him over time where it does impact him when he hears his name getting tossed around.
You wouldn't think it would to an NBA caliber player like that, but... Anyways, I want to switch now to the Bruins, which is another Boston team that's having just a spectacular, it's unbelievable how well they're doing this season. Fluto, I want to bring you into the conversation here. Do you expect the Bruins to make any major moves before the NHL deadline on March 3rd?
Yeah, they're in a pretty unique position, Simone, because, as you said, this is a team on a historic run. It has no weaknesses, but... even in basketball, there are injuries. There will be more injuries in hockey, just given the nature of the sport. So, yes, I expect the Bruins to be active in the trade market, but they do have a challenge in terms of the salary cap. Every team is restricted at the $82.5 million ceiling, and the Bruins, once they get fully healthy, they'll be right up against it. So any big-ticket player that they acquire, there is going to have to be money going out the door, pretty much dollar for dollar for the teams to match up. So yes, they'll be active, but it comes down to math. There's going to have to be some equations going on to make sure the dollars heading in and out are equal, but yes, they will be acquiring help.
Is there any chance they could do like restructuring certain deals as well, or it's got to be money out the door?
The one wrinkle they can add, Chris, is salary retention. So say if Team A has a player that the Bruins want, then they can retain 50% of that player's salary, which is helpful. But for the Bruins, it's got to be more than that too.
Fluto Shinzawa, senior writer for the Athletic, Bruins expert here. There was a lot of chatter going into this season that, you know, it's kind of one more run for these guys, Patrice Bergeron, David Krejci. Is that how you see this season, or could this be the end? Is it our final chance at another Stanley Cup?
On one side, Patrice Bergeron, 37 years old. David Krejci, 36 years old.
Okay.
These are old guys, especially given the nature of the league. And you don't have that many players of that age doing what they're doing. But then when you look at what they're doing, they are performing exceptionally. David Krejci is high, I think third or fourth on the team in scoring. Patrice Bergeron does everything. So this is not looking like players that are headed right to the rocking chairs right after this season, that perhaps if they want to, maybe they can come back for another year.
Get the band back together.
Absolutely. So but you also have to be cognizant of that, Chris, if you're management, to say, okay, this could be reality. They could say, we're done. We want out. So where does that leave you next year? That's without your two top centers and two critical players in terms of performance and team culture. You can't just replace that. So that's what they have to be mindful of, to build for today in terms of reinforcing this possible championship roster. But you can't just say, okay, we're all in, and then where are you left with for tomorrow?
Covering these guys, I'm just wondering, I know obviously you're not in their heads, but do you get any sense the way they talk about the game or kind of the grind or kind of where their heads are at, or is it just way too early to?
Well, I know that they know that this is as good of an opportunity to win the cup as they've ever had, even dating back to 2011. That team was not a number one from start to finish favorite. This is something unique, and they know it. They know this opportunity is as good as it's going to get, so they're going to maximize every chance. If you're the player, if you're the team, if you're the coach, this is a real, real good chance to put the cup over their heads.
Fluto, what changed this season to make the team so good? Did they add some pieces? What happened?
I think there's several reasons. You look at the depth. They have depth at every position. They have two number one goalies in Linus Allmark and Jeremy Swayman. They have two top centers, Patrice Bergeron, David Krejci. They have two number one defensemen, Hampus Lindholm, Charlie McAvoy. But I think one of the big pieces was the coaching change. That, yes, Bruce Cassidy got them success 6 straight years into the playoffs, but I think in retrospect, firing Bruce and replacing him with Jim Montgomery, Jim is a very sharp mind when it comes to offense, but also emphasizing defense. But I just think there's a lighter load around the players this year that they are, I think, in hindsight, they were wary of what Bruce had done in terms of how he managed the team and how he coached the team and was very demanding. And Jim is just, he has a lighter approach. And I think that's really taken a lot of pressure off the players, and they are performing way above their expectations because of that.
Well, that happened with the Celtics, too. I mean, they didn't expect to have a new coach this season. Everybody was wondering going into the season if they were going to be able to keep up that momentum, and they sure did.
Absolutely.
That happened on the Bruins, too.
Yeah, and I think chemistry has been a big part of what the Celtics have done. You've seen that core kind of stick together. And so coming back to the trade deadline, that's what I was curious, Fluto, if you think how do you think chemistry kind of plays into a hockey team's success? Is it crucial that, you know, when you're getting a guy, he fits both kind of the needs on the ice and the needs in the locker room?
Yeah.
How much does that matter?
Critical, Chris. Especially when you look at, historically, we've seen teams in this position, they don't send off roster players.
Yeah.
This is a very tight group. There would be some ripples in the room if they sent, say, a roster player out the door. So that's where the Bruins will
and by that, you just mean a guy who's up on the team.
On the team, yes. This is a team in position to trade out picks and prospects, players that will not affect this year's roster.
We got some big kind of NHL Boston Marty Walsh news. I understand he's going to be maybe taking a new job.
Hit this last week when there were rumors he was a front runner, but former Boston Mayor Marty Walsh is going to be the new head of the NHL Players Association. Curious, Fluto, kind of what you think of that choice and what his approach is going to be.
Yeah, Marty's a big hockey fan. He had some pretty strong ties with the Bruins in terms of the business side. I know he was pretty critical in terms of getting Warrior Ice Arena, their practice facility in Brighton, up and running in 2016. So he's a big fan, which helps. If you look at the rest of the sports, the players have a lot of room to grow in terms of salaries. You look at the salaries, NBA, baseball, football, they're making way more than what some of the hockey players are making. So, okay, it's a niche sport. I get it. It's not as popular as some of the other sports. It's very dependent on gates versus TV revenues. But I think that's where the executive director will have a lot of work to do, is just making sure that the players get their share of the pie.
That's the biggest priority, you think?
Absolutely.
When he takes over? Yeah.
Absolutely. And the players, they still owe money to the owners in terms of escrow because of, is getting into the weeds here, but because of COVID, that they were earning their salaries while the league went dark and shut their doors. So the players still owe their employers some money. So they're not happy about the amount they're paying in escrow.
Let's bring John Marshall back into the conversation. He's a sports reporter up at WMUR in Manchester, New Hampshire. John, Tom Brady and his old coach, Bill Belichick, had a kind of coming to Jesus moment in recent days. What's your take on that?
Hey, man, look, time, you know, you get older, you mature a little bit. I think you get a little more emotional. Time is seeing things is coming to an end. You have some time for reflection. You know, as humans, you know, we get that time to reflect, and just life is too short for any beef that you may have. And you just realize just how crucial certain people or certain seasons in your life really were. And I think Tom and Bill have really acknowledged that. And so it was great to see. It was great to see. So we'll see if he'll sign up to be a Pat for one day and retire. I think it's only right.
You know, we touched on this last week, and I was saying I was hoping for it at the time. I'm kind of thinking it's less and less likely as time goes on here. Tom hasn't really addressed that whole one-day contract issue. Yeah. And you know what I found really interesting about that whole back and forth, John? Robert Kraft, the owner of the Patriots, never really came up in that conversation. So it was almost like Brady and Belichick were burying the hatchet a little bit and playing nice. But there was this kind of elephant in the room of what's Brady's relationship with the organization and with ownership, and has that soured in a way that maybe, you know, the Brady-Belichick thing was very front and center. We all saw it, right? You could see it on the sidelines and in press conferences after the game. Do you think there's some underlying tension with the Krafts maybe in Brady?
There might, you know, just considering how that whole situation ended, you know, leaving New England. It still didn't, he didn't get his proper, you know, the send off, the farewell still didn't seem complete, right? And so you're wondering.
Well, he still wanted to stay here as late as August, and he was like, sign me, I want to be here. So, yeah, I can see why he might be a little miffed about the idea of signing a one-day contract. Like, yeah, you could have signed me. You had your chance.
Well,
yeah,
John, I like your idea of forgiveness. Let bygones be bygones.
Yeah.
I tell you, I could use some of that in my life. I think we probably all could a little bit. But, Fluto, I'm going to throw it to you for the Tom Brady, Bill Belichick reconciliation? How do you feel?
Boy, that's a tough one just because I really don't have any insight in terms of the room. But I think what you see are just two people at the tops of their professions for so long, right? And perhaps there's some stubbornness there. I'm sure there are egos. You don't get to the positions that those folks get to without being, and this is going to sound, maybe this is the wrong word, but selfish. Let's put it that way, that this is all about me.
Egos,
you have, absolutely. Yeah. You believe in yourself 100%. You think you're the best. You think there's nobody better. So perhaps there's some of that going on.
Well, 20 years of it, too. That is a long time. There's going to be some ups and downs, right?
Yeah, they had a good run. Well, Jonathan Marshall, sports reporter for WMUR in Manchester. Thank you for being here. We also heard from Fluto Shinzawa, senior writer for The Athletic. Great to be with you in the studio. And WBUR's Chris Sitterick. Thanks so much to all three of you.
Thank you,
Pleasure.
So much.
Thank you, guys.
That's our show for today. Radio Boston is a production of 90.9 WBUR, Boston's NPR news station. I'm Simone Rios. Join us again tomorrow for more Radio Boston.